information being communicated and the information being requested. John is the loudest word because it is particularly important to the speaker for the hearer to tell him what John did. Maybe Mary is a librarian. People give her books all day, every day. Then what is being asked is not about what Susie gave her, but only what John gave her. The pitch and loudness let the hearer know this so that they do not have to sort through all the people who gave Mary things yesterday. The word John already makes this clear. The pitch and loudness highlight this. They offer additional cues to the hearer to guide their mental search for the right information. Now, when someone asks this question, what does the asker look like? Probably they look something like this. The upper arms are held against their sides, with their forearms extended, palms facing outward and their brow furrowed. These body and hand expressions are important. The hearer uses these gestural, facial, and other body cues to know immediately that you are not making a statement. A question is being asked. Now consider the words themselves. The word yesterday appears at the very beginning of the sentence, on the far left, when written. In the sentences that follow, the other places that yesterday could appear in the sentence are explored. What did John give yesterday to Mary in the library? Yesterday, what did John give to Mary in the library? What did John, yesterday, give to Mary in the library? What did John give to Mary yesterday in the library? What did John give to Mary in the library yesterday? What, yesterday, did John give to Mary in the library? But a native speaker is less likely to ask the question like this. What did yesterday John give to Mary in the library? What did John give to yesterday Mary in the library? What did John give to Mary in yesterday the library? What did John give to Mary in the yesterday library? One is perhaps less likely to hear these sentences, other than in a very specific context, if at all. This exercise could be continued with other words or phrases of the sample sentence. In the library, what did John give to Mary yesterday? This exercise on words and their orders need not be continued, however, since there is now enough information to know that putting together a sentence is not simply stringing words like beads on a cord. Part of the organization of the sentence is the grouping of words in most languages into phrases. These phrases should not be interrupted, which is why one cannot place yesterday after the word in or after the word the. Grammatical phrases are forms of chunking for short-term memory. They aid recall and interpretation. Still, a great deal of cultural information is missing from the example. For instance, what in the hell is a library? Is John a man or a woman? Is Mary a man or a woman? Which library is being talked about? What kinds of things are most likely to be given by John? Do John and Mary know each other? Although there are a lot of questions, one quickly perceives the answers to them, if they are the speaker or hearer in the conversation, because of the knowledge people absorb, often without instruction, from their surrounding society and culture. People use individual knowledge, such as which library is the most likely candidate, and cultural knowledge, such as what a library is, to narrow down their solution space as hearers. They are not, therefore, obligated to sort through all possible information to understand and respond, but must only mentally scroll through the culturally and individually most pertinent information that might fit the question at hand. The syntax, word selection, intonation, and amplitude are all designed to help understand what was just said. But there's more, such as certain kinds of information in the example here. There is shared information, signaled sometimes by words such as the in the phrase, the library. Because someone says the library and not a library, they signal to the hearer that this is a library that both know. They share this knowledge because of the context in which they are having this conversation. The request here is for new information, as signaled by the question word, what? This is information that the speaker does not have, but expects the hearer to have. Sentences exist to facilitate information exchange between speakers. Grammar is simply a tool to facilitate that. The question is also an intentional act, an action intended to elicit a particular kind of action from the hearer. The action desired here is, give me the information I wish, or tell me where to get it. Actions vary. Thus, if a king were to say, off with his head, the action desired would be a decapitation, if he were being literal. Literalness brings us to another twist on how sentences are uttered and understood. Is the speaker being literal, or ironic, or figurative? Are they insane? With language, speakers can recognize promises, declarations, indirect requests, direct requests, denunciations, legal impact, I now pronounce you man and wife, and other culturally significant information points. No theory of language should neglect to tell us about the complexity of language and how its parts fit together. Intonation, gestures, grammar, lexical choice, type of intention, and the rest. And what does the hearer do in this river of signals and information? Does she sit and ponder for hours before giving an answer? No. She understands all of this implicitly and instantly. These cues work together. Taken as one, they make the sentence easier to understand, not harder. And the evidence is that the single strongest force driving this instantaneous comprehension is information structure. What is new? What is shared? And this derives not merely from the literal meanings of the words, but from that implicit cultural knowledge that I call dark matter. Into the syntactic representation of a sentence, speakers intercalate gestures and intonation. They use these gestures as annotations to indicate the presence of implicit information from the culture and the personal experiences of the speaker and hearer. But something is always left out. The language never expresses everything. The culture fills in the details. How did human languages go from simple symbols to this complex interaction between higher-level symbols, symbols within symbols, grammar, intonation, gesture, and culture? And why does all of this vary so much from language to language and culture to culture? Using the same words in British English or Australian English or Indian English or American English will produce related but distinct presupposed knowledge, intonational patterns, gestures, and facial expressions. Far from there being any universal grammar of integrating the various aspects of a single utterance, each culture largely follows its own head. There are universally shared aspects of language, of course. Every culture uses pitch, attaches gestures, and orders words in some agreed-upon sequence. These are necessary limits and features of language because they reflect physical and mental limitations of the species. Maybe, and this is exciting to think about, some of this represents vestiges of the ways that Homo erectus talked. Maybe humans passed a lot of grammar down by example from millennium to millennium as the species continued to evolve. It is possible that modern languages have maintained 2 million-year-old solutions to information transfer first invented by Homo erectus. This possibility cannot be dismissed. Reviewing what we have learned about symbols, these are based on a simple principle. namely, that an arbitrary form can represent a meaning. Each symbol also entails Peirce's interpretant. Signs in all their forms are a first step towards another essential component of human language, the triple patterning of form and meaning via the addition of the interpretative aids of gestures and intonation. As symbols and the rest become more enculturated, they advance up the ladder from communication to language to a distinction between the perspective of the outsider versus the perspective of the insider, what linguist Kenneth Pike referred to as the edic, outsider viewpoint, and the emic, insider viewpoint. Signs alone do not get us all the way to the edic and the emic. Culture is crucial all along the way. The edic perspective is the perspective a tourist might have listening to a foreign language for the first time. They talk too fast. I don't know how they understand one another with all those weird sounds. But as one learns to speak the language, the sounds become more familiar. The language doesn't sound as though it is spoken all that rapidly after all. The language and its rules and pronunciation patterns become familiar. The learner has traveled from the edic perspective of the outsider to the emic perspective of the insider. By associating meanings with forms to create symbols, the distinction between form and meaning is highlighted. And because symbols are interpreted by members of a particular group, they lead to the insider interpretation versus the outsider interpretation. This is what makes languages understandable to native speakers, but difficult to learn for non-native speakers. The progression to language is just this. Indexes, then icons, then emic symbols, plus emic grammar, emic gestures, and emic intonation. Following symbols, another important invention for language is grammar. Structure is needed to make more complex utterances out of symbols. A set of organizing principles is required. These enable us to form utterances efficiently and most in line with the cultural expectations of the hearers. Grammars are organized in two ways at once. Vertically, also known as paradigmatic organization, and horizontally, referred to as syntagmatic organization. These modes of organization underlie all grammars, as was pointed out at the beginning of the 20th century by Swiss linguist Ferdinand de Saussure. Both vertical and horizontal organization of a grammar work together to facilitate communication by allowing more information to be packed into individual words and phrases of language than would be possible without them. These modes of organization follow from the nature of symbols and the transmission of information. If one has symbols and sounds, then there is no huge mental leap required to put these in some linear order. Linguists call the placing together of meaningless sounds, phonemes is the name given to speech sounds, into meaningful words, duality of patterning. For example, the S, A, and T of the word sat are meaningless on their own, but assembled in this order, the word they form does have meaning. To form words, phonemes are taken from the list of a given language's sounds, and placed into slots to form a word, as, again, in sat, S, slot 1, A, slot 2, T, slot 3. And once this duality becomes conventionalized, agreed upon by the members of a culture, then it can be extended to combine meaningful items with meaningful items. From there, it is not a huge leap to use symbols for events and symbols for things together to make statements. Assume that one has a list of symbols. This is one aspect of the vertical or paradigmatic aspect of the grammar. Next, there is an order to place these symbols in that a culture has agreed upon for the organization of the symbols. So, the task in forming a sentence or a phrase is to choose a symbol and place it in a slot, as is illustrated in Figure 26 in the bonus PDF. Knowing the grammar, which every speaker must, is just knowing the instructions for assembling the words into sentences. The simple grammar for this made-up language might just be, select one paradigmatic filler and place it in appropriate syntagmatic slot. From the idea that there is an inventory of symbols to be placed in a specific order, not a huge jump cognitively, early humans would have been using the ideas of slot and filler. These are the bases of all grammars. All of this was first explained by linguist Charles Hockett in 1960. He called the combination of meaningless elements to make meaningful ones duality of patterning. And once a people have symbols plus duality of patterning, then they extend duality to get the syntagmatic and paradigmatic organization in the chart found in the bonus PDF. This almost gets us to human language. Only two other things are necessary, gestures and intonation. These together give the full language, symbols plus gestures and intonation. Here, though, the focus is on duality of patterning. As people organize their symbols, they naturally begin next to analyze their symbols into smaller units. Thus a word such as cat, a symbol, is organized horizontally or syntagmatically as a syllable, C-A-T. But with this organization, it also becomes clear that cat is organized vertically at the same time. So one could substitute a P for the C of cat to produce the word pat. Or one could substitute D for T and get instead cad. In other words, cat has three slots, C-A-T, and fillers for each slot come from the speech sounds of English. The syllable is therefore itself an important part of the development of duality of patterning. It is a natural organizing constraint set on the arrangement of phonemes that works to enable each phoneme to be better perceived. It has other functions, but the crucial point is that it is primarily an aid to perception, arising from the matching of ears to vocal apparatus over the course of human evolution, rather than a pre-specified mental category. A very simple characterization of the syllable is that speech sounds are arranged in order. The order preferred most of the time is that, from left to right in the syllable, the sounds are arranged from least inherently loud to the loudest, and then back to the softest. This makes the sounds in each syllable easier to hear. It is another way of chunking that helps our brains to keep track of what is going on in language. This property is called sonority. In simple terms, a sound is more sonorous if it is louder. Consonants are less sonorous than vowels, and among consonants, some, these need not worry us here, are less sonorous than others. Thus, syllables are units of speech in which the individual slots produce a crescendo-decrescendo effect, where the nucleus or central part is the most sonorous element, usually a vowel, while at the margins are the least sonorous elements. This is shown by the syllable bad. This is an acceptable syllable in English because B and D are less sonorous than A and are found in the margins of the syllable, while A, the most sonorous element, is in the nuclear or central position. The syllable bda, on the other hand, would be ill-formed in English because a less sonorous sound, B, is followed by another less sonorous consonant sound, D, rather than immediately by an increase in sonority. This makes it hard to hear, or hard to distinguish B and D when they are placed together in the margin of the syllable. Languages vary tremendously in syllabic organization. Certain ones, like English, have very complicated syllable patterns. The word strength has more than one consonant in each margin, and the consonant S should follow the consonant T at the beginning of strength, because it is more sonorant. so the word should actually be strength. It does not take this form because English has historically preferred the order ST, based on sound patterns of earlier stages of English and the languages that influenced it, as well as cultural choice. History and culture are common factors that override and violate the otherwise purely phonetic organization of syllables. This perceptual and articulatory organization of the syllable brings duality of patterning to language naturally. By organizing sounds so that they can be more easily heard, languages, in effect, get this patterning for free. Each margin and nucleus of a syllable is part of the horizontal organization of the syllable, while the sounds that can go into the margin or nucleus are the fillers. And that means that the syllable, in a sense, could have been the key to grammar and more complex languages. Again, the syllable is based upon a simple idea. Chunk sounds, so as to make them easier to hear and to remember. Homo erectus would have probably have had syllables because they just follow from the shortness of our short-term memory in conjunction with the easiest arrangements to hear. If so, then this means that erectus would have had grammar practically given to them on a platter as soon as they used syllables. It is, of course, possible that syllables came later in language evolution than, say, words and sentences, but any type of sound organization, whether in phonemes of Homo sapiens or other sounds by erectus or neanderthalensis, would entail a more powerful form of organizing a language and moving it beyond mere symbols to some form of grammar. Thus, early speech would have been a stimulus to syntagmatic and paradigmatic organization in syntax, morphology, and elsewhere in language. In fact, some other animals, such as cotton-top tamarins, are also claimed to have syllables. Whatever tamarins can do, the bet is that erectus could do better. If tamarins had better-equipped brains, then they'd be on their way to human language. If this is on the right track, duality of patterning, along with gestures and intonation, are the foundational organizational principles of language. However, once these elements are in place, it would be expected that languages would discover the utility of hierarchy, which computer scientists and psychologists have argued to be ever useful in the transmission or storage of complex information. Phonology is, like all other forms of human behavior, constrained by the memory expression tension. The more units that a language has, the less ambiguously it can express messages, but the more there is to learn and memorize. So, if a language had 300 speech sounds, it could produce words that were less ambiguous than a language with only 5 speech sounds. But this has a cost. The language with more speech sounds is harder to learn. Phonology organizes sounds to make them easier to perceive, adding a few local cultural modifications preferred by a particular community, as English strength instead of strength. This gets to the coevolution of the articulatory and auditory apparatuses. The relationship between humans' ears and their mouths is what accounts for the sounds of all human languages. It is what makes human speech sounds different than, say, Martian speech sounds. The articulatory apparatus of humans is, of course, also interesting because no single part of it, other than its shape, is specialized for speech. The human vocal apparatus has 3 basic components: moving parts, the articulators, stationary parts, the points of articulation, and airflow generators. It is worth underscoring again the fact that the evolution of the vocal apparatus for speech is likely to have followed the beginning of language. Though language can exist without well-developed speech abilities, many modern languages can be whistled, hummed, or signed, There can be no speech without language. Neanderthalensis did not have speech capabilities like those of sapiens, but they most certainly could have had a working language without a sapien's vocal apparatus. The inability of Neanderthalensis to produce E, A, and U, at least according to Philip Lieberman, would be a handicap for speech, but these cardinal or quantal vowels are neither necessary nor sufficient for language. Not necessary because of signed languages, not sufficient because parrots can produce them. Speech is enhanced, as has been mentioned, when the auditory system co-evolves with the articulatory system. This just means that human ears and mouths evolve together. Humans therefore get better at hearing the sounds their mouths most easily make, and making the sounds their ears most easily perceive. Individual speech sounds, phones, are produced by the articulators, tongue and lips for the most part, meeting or approximating points of articulation, alveolar ridge, teeth, palate, lips, and so on. Some of these sounds are louder because they offer minimal impedance to the flow of air out of the mouth, and for many out of the nose. These are vowels. No articulator makes direct contact with a point of articulation in the production of vowels. Other phones completely or partially impede the flow of air out of the mouth. These are consonants. With both consonants and vowels, the stream of sounds produced by any speaker can be organized so as to maximize both information rate. Consonants generally carry more information than vowels, since there are more of them, and perceptual clarity. Consonants are easier to perceive in different positions of a speech stream, such as immediately preceding and following vowels, and the beginnings and ends of words. Vowels and consonants, since speech is not digital in its production, but rather a continuous stream of articulatory movements, assimilate to one another. That is, they become more alike in some contexts, though not always the same contexts in every language. If a native speaker of English utters the word clock, the K at the end is pronounced further back in the mouth than it is when they pronounce the word click. This is because the vowel O is further back in the mouth, and the vowel I is further to the front of the mouth. In these cases, the vowel pulls the consonant toward its place of articulation. Additional modifications to sounds enhance perception of speech sounds. Another example is known as aspiration, a puff of air made when producing a sound, or voicing, what happens as the vocal cords vibrate while producing a sound. Syllable structure is another modification when sounds are pronounced differently in different positions of a syllable. This is seen in the pronunciation of L when it is at the end of a syllable, as in the word bull, versus L when it is at the beginning of a syllable, as in leaf. To literally see aspiration, hold a piece of paper about 1 inch in front of your mouth and pronounce the word paper. The paper will move. Now do the same while pronouncing the word spa. The paper will not move on the P of spa if one is a native speaker of English. These enhancements are ignored often by native speakers when they produce speech, because such enhancements are simply add-ons and not part of the target sound. This is why native speakers of English do not normally hear a difference between the P of spa and the P, superscript H, of paper, where the superscript H, following a consonant, indicates aspiration. But to the linguist, these sounds are quite distinct. Speakers are unaware of such enhancements and usually can learn to hear them only with special effort. The study of the physical properties of sounds, regardless of the speaker's perceptions and organization of them, is phonetics. The study of the emic knowledge of speakers, what enhancements are ignored by native speakers, and what sounds they target is phonology. Continuing on with our study of phonology, there is a long tradition that breaks basic sounds, vowels, and consonants down further into phonetic features, plus or minus voiced, voiced versus non-voiced, or plus or minus advanced tongue root, as in the contrast between the English vowels I of beat and the vowel I of bit, and so on. But no harm is done to the exposition of language evolution if such finer details are ignored. Moving up the phonological hierarchy, we arrive once again at the syllable the, which introduces duality of patterning into speech sound organization. To elaborate slightly further on what was said earlier about the syllable, consider the syllables in Figure 27 of the bonus PDF. As per the earlier discussion of sonority, it is expected that the syllable sat will be well-formed, ceteris paribus, while the syllable labad will not be, because in the latter the sounds are harder to perceive. The syllable is thus a hierarchical, non-recursive structuring of speech sounds. It functions to enhance the perceptibility of phones, and often works in languages as the basic rhythmic unit. Once again, one can imagine that, given their extremely useful contributions to speech perception, syllables began to appear early on in the linking of sounds to meaning in language. They would have been a very useful and easy addition to speech, dramatically improving the perceptibility of speech sounds. The natural limitations of human auditory and articulatory systems would have exerted pressure for speakers to hear and produce syllabic organization early on. However, once introduced, syllables, segments, and other units of the phonological hierarchy would have undergone culture-based elaborations. Changes, in other words, are made to satisfy local preferences, without regard for ease of pronunciation or production. These elaborations are useful for group identification, as well as the perceptions of sounds in certain places in the words. So, sometimes they are motivated by ease of hearing or pronunciation or by cultural reasons in order to make sounds that identified one group as the source of those sounds, because speakers of one culture would have preferred some sounds to others, some enhancements to others, and so on. A particular language's inventory of sounds might also be culturally limited. This all means that in the history of languages, a set of cultural preferences emerges that selects among the sounds that humans can produce and perceive to choose the sounds that a particular culture at a particular time in the development of the language chooses to use. After this selection, the preferred sounds and patterns will change over time, subject to new articulatory, auditory, or cultural pressures, or via contact with other languages. Other units of the phonological hierarchy include phonological phrases, groupings of syllables into phonological words or units larger than words. These phrases or words are also forms of chunking to aid working memory and to facilitate faster interpretation of information communicated. This segmentation is aided by gestures and intonation, which offer backup help to speech for perception and working memory. In this way, the grouping of smaller linguistic units, such as sounds, into larger linguistic units, such as syllables and words and phrases, facilitates communication. Phrases and words are themselves grouped into larger groupings some linguists have referred to as contours or breath groups, groupings of sound marked by breathing and intonation. We have mentioned that pitch, loudness, and the lengthening or shortening of some words or phrases can be used to distinguish, say, new information from old information, such as the topic we are currently discussing, old information, and a comment about that topic, new information. These can also be used to signal emphasis and other nuances that the speaker would like the hearer to pick up on about what is being communicated. all of these uses of phonology emerge gradually as humans move from indexes to grammar. And every step of the way, they would have, in all likelihood, been accompanied by gesture. From these baby steps, an entire phonological hierarchy is constructed. This hierarchy entails that most elements of the sound structure of a given language are composed of smaller elements. In other words, each unit of sound is built up from smaller units via natural processes that make it easier to hear and produce the sounds of a given language. The standard linguistic view of the phonological hierarchy is given in Figure 28, which can be found in the bonus PDF. Our sound structures are also constrained by two other sets of factors. The first is environment. Sound structures can be significantly constrained by the environmental conditions in which the language arose. Average temperatures, humidity, atmospheric pressure, and so on. Linguists missed these connections for most of the history of language, though more recent research has now established them clearly. Thus, to understand the evolution of a specific language, one must know something about both its original culture and its ecological circumstances. No language is an island. Several researchers summarize these generalizations with the proposal that the first utterances of humans were holophrastic, that is, the first attempts at communication were unstructured utterances that were neither words nor sentences, simply interjections or exclamations. If an erectus used the same expression over and over to refer to a saber-toothed cat, say, how might or would that symbol be decomposed into smaller pieces? Gestures, with functions that overlap intonation in some ways, contribute to decomposing a larger unit into smaller constituents, either reinforcing already highlighted portions or by indicating that other portions of the utterance are of secondary importance, but still more than portions of tertiary importance, and so on. To see how this might work, imagine that an erectus woman saw a large cat run by her, and she exclaimed, "Shamalama ding-dong!" One of those syllables, or portions of that utterance, might be louder or higher pitched than the others. If she were emotional, that would necessarily come through in gestures and pitches that would intentionally or inadvertently highlight different portions of that utterance. Perhaps such as, "Shamalama ding-dong," or "Shamalama ding-dong," or "Shamalama ding-dong," or "Shamalama ding-dong," and so forth. If her gestures, loudness, pitch, high or low or medium, lined up with the same syllables, then those would perhaps begin to get recognition as parts of a word or sentence that began without any parts. Prosody, pitch, loudness, length, gestures and other markers of salience, body positioning, eyebrow raising, etc., have the joint effect of beginning to decompose the utterance, breaking it down into parts according to their pitch or gestures. Once utterances are decomposed, and only then, they can be recomposed, synthesized, to build additional utterances. And this leads to another necessary property of human language, semantic compositionality. This is crucial for all languages. It is the ability to encode or decode a meaning of a whole utterance from the individual meaning of its parts. Thus, from natural processes linking sound and meaning in utterances, there is an easy path via gestures, intonation, duration, and amplitude to decomposing an initially unstructured whole into parts, and from there recomposing parts into wholes. And this is the birth of all grammars. No special genes required. Kenneth Pike placed morphology and syntax together in another hierarchy, worth repeating here, though I use my own slightly adapted version. This he called the morphosyntactic hierarchy, the building up of conversations from smaller and smaller parts. How innovations, linguistic or otherwise, spread and become part of a language is a puzzle known as the actuation problem. Just as with the spread of new words or expressions or jokes today, several possible enabling factors might be involved in the origin and spread of linguistic innovations. Speakers might like the sounds of certain components of novel erectus utterances more than others, or an accompanying pitch and or gesture might have highlighted one portion of the utterance to the exclusion of other parts. As highlighting is also picked up by others and begins to circulate for whatever reasons, the highlighted, more salient portion becomes more important in the transmission and perception of the utterance being actuated. It is likely that the first utterance was made to communicate to someone else. Of course, there are no witnesses. Nevertheless, the prior and subsequent history of the language progression strongly support this. Language is about communication. The possibly clearer thinking that comes when we can think in speech instead of merely, say, in pictures, is a byproduct of language. It is not itself what language is about. Just as there is no need to appeal to genes for syntax, the evidence suggests that neither are sound structures innate, aside from the innate vocal apparatus auditory perception link between what sounds people can best produce and hear. The simplest hypothesis is that the coevolution of the vocal apparatus, the hearing apparatus, and linguistic organizational principles led to the existence of a well-organized, sound-based system of forms for representing meanings as part of signs. There are external, functional, and ecological constraints on the evolution of sound systems. Syntax develops with duality of patterning and additions to it that are based on cultural communicational objectives and conventions, along with different grammatical strategies. This means that one can add recursion if it is a culturally beneficial strategy. One can have relative clauses or not. One can have conjoined noun phrases or not. Some examples of different grammar strategies in English include sentences like, John and Mary went to town, a complex conjoined noun phrase, versus John went to town, Mary went to town. Two simple sentences. The man is tall. The man is here. Two simple sentences versus the man who is tall is here. A complex sentence with a relative clause. Morphology is the scientific term for how words are constructed. Different languages use different word-building strategies, though the set of workable strategies is small. Thus, in English, there are at most 5 different forms of any verb. Sing, sang, sung, singing, sings. Some verbs have even fewer forms. Hit, hitting, hits. There are really only a few choices for building morphological word structures. Words can be simple or composed of parts called morphemes. If they are simple, without internal divisions, this is an isolating language. Chinese is one illustration. In Chinese, there is usually no past tense form for a verb. A separate word is necessary to indicate past tense, or just the context. So where we would say in English, I ran, past tense, versus I run, present tense, in Chinese, you might say, I now run, 3 words, versus I yesterday run, 3 words. In another language, such as Portuguese, the strategy for building words is different. Like many Romance languages, those descended from Latin, Portuguese words can combine several meanings. A simple example can be constructed from falo, which means I speak in Portuguese. The O ending of the verb means several things at once. It indicates first person singular, I. But it also means present tense, and it also means indicative mood, which in turn means, very roughly, this really is happening. The O of fallo also means that the verb is of the dash AR set of verbs. Falach, to speak. Quebrach, to break. Olhar, to look. And many, many others. Portuguese and other languages descended from Latin, such as Spanish, Romanian, Italian, are known as Romance languages. They are referred to linguistically as inflectional languages. Other languages, such as Turkish and many Native American languages, are called agglutinative. This means that each part of each word often has a single meaning, unlike Romance languages, where each part of the word can have several meanings, as in the O of falo. A single word in Turkish can be long and have many parts, but each part has but a single meaning. Czechoslovakia lilashtera madikla remiz dan mish siniz jisina. As if you were one of those whom we could not make resemble the Czechoslovakian people. Some inflectional languages even have special kinds of morphemes called circumfixes. In German, the past tense of the verb spielen, to play, is gespielt, where GE at the beginning and T at the end jointly express the past tense, circumscribing the verb they affect. Other languages use pitch to add meaning to words. This produces what are called simulfixes. In Piraha, the nearly identical words a-a-aga, permanent quality, versus a-a-aga, temporary quality, are distinguished only by the high tone on the first vowel, a. So I could say, ti baha ahai, a-a-aga, I am nice always, or ti baha ahai, a-a-aga, I am nice at present. Or one could express some meaning on the consonants and another part of the meaning of the word on the vowels, in which case we have a non-concatenative system. Arabic languages are of this type, but English also has examples. So foot is singular, but feet is plural, where we have kept the consonants F and T the same, but changed the vowels. It is unlikely that any language has a pure system of word structure, using only one of these strategies just exemplified. Languages tend to mix different approaches to building words. The mixing is often caused by historical accidents, remnants of earlier stages of the language's development, or contact with other languages. But what this brief summary of word formation shows is that if we look at all the morphological systems of the world, the basic principles are easy. This is summarized in Figure 30, found in the bonus PDF. These are the choices that every culture has to make. It could choose multiples of these, but simplicity, for memory's sake, will favor less rather than more mixing of the systems. From the beginnings of the invention of symbols, at least 1.9 million years ago by Homo erectus, there has been sufficient time to discover this small range of possibilities and, via the grammar, meaning, pitches, and gestures of language, to build morphological systems from them. Arguably, the greatest contribution Noam Chomsky has made to the understanding of human languages is his classification of different kinds of grammars, based on their computational and mathematical properties. This classification has become known as the Chomsky Hierarchy of Grammars, though it was heavily influenced by the work of Emil Post and Marcel Schützenberger. Yet while Chomsky's work is insightful and has been used for decades by computer scientists, psychologists, and linguists, it denies that language is a system for communication. Therefore, in spite of its influence, it is ignored here in order to discuss a less complicated but arguably more effective way at looking at grammar's place in the evolution of language as a communicative tool. The claim is that, contrary to some theories, there are various kinds of grammars available to the world's languages and cultures. linear grammars, hierarchical grammars, and recursive hierarchical grammars. These systems are available to all languages, and they are only systems for organizing grammar. There are only three organizational templates for human syntax. In principle, this is not excessively difficult. A linear grammar would be an arrangement of words left to right in a culturally specified order. In other words, linear grammars are not merely the stringing of words without thought. A language might stipulate that the basic order of its words is subject noun plus predicate verb plus direct object noun, producing sentences like John, subject noun, hit, predicate verb, Bill, direct object noun. Or, if we look at the Amazonian language, Hishkariana, the order would be object noun plus predicate verb plus subject noun. This would produce Bill, object noun, hit, predicate verb, John, subject noun. And this sentence would be translated into English from Hishkariana, in spite of its order of words, as John hit Bill. These word orders, like all constituents in human languages, are not mysterious grammatical processes disassociated from communication. On the contrary, the data suggest that every bit of grammar evolves to aid short-term memory and the understanding of utterances. Throughout all languages heretofore studied, grammatical strategies are used to keep track of which words are more closely related. One common strategy of linking related words is to place words closer to words whose meaning they most affect. Another, usually in conjunction with the first, is to place words in phrases hierarchically, as in one possible grammatical structure for the phrase, John's Very Big Book, shown in Figure 31 of the bonus PDF. In this phrase, there are chunks or constituents within chunks. The constituent very big is a chunk of the larger phrase, very big book. One way to keep track of which words are most closely related is to mark them with case or agreement. Greek and Latin allow words that are related to be separated by other words in a sentence, so long as they are all marked with the same case, genitive, ablative, accusative, nominative, and so on. Consider the Greek sentences described in English orthography, all of which mean Antigone adores surrealism, found in the bonus PDF. All of these sentences are grammatical in Greek. All are regularly found. The Greek language, like Latin and many other languages, allows freer word order than, say, English, because the cases, such as nominative and accusative, distinguish the object from the subject. In English, since we rarely use case, word order, not case, has been adopted by our culture as the way to keep straight who did what to whom. But even English has case to a small degree. I, nominative, saw him, objective. He, nominative, saw me, objective. But not me, saw he, or him, saw I. English pronouns are marked for case. I and he are nominative. Me and him are objective. We see agreement in all English sentences, as in he likes John. Here, he is third person singular, and so the verb carries the third person singular's s ending on likes to agree with the subject, he. But if we say instead, I like John, the verb is not likes, but like, because the pronoun I is not third person. Agreement is simply another way to keep track of word relationships in a sentence. Placing words together in linear order without additional structure is an option used by some languages to organize their grammars, avoiding tree structures and recursion. Even primates such as Coco, the gorilla, have been able to master such word order-based structures. It certainly would have been within the capabilities of Homo erectus to master such a language, and would have been the first strategy to be used, and is still used in a few modern languages, such as perhaps Piraha and the Indonesian language Riau. One thing that all grammars must have is a way to assemble the meanings of the parts of an utterance to form the meaning of the whole utterance. How do the three words he, John, and see come to mean he sees John in a sentence? The meaning of each of the words is put together in phrases and sentences. This is called compositionality, without which there can be no language. This property can simply be built off the phrases in a tree structure directly, which is the case for most languages, such as English, Spanish, Turkish, and thousands of others. But it can also be built in a linear grammar. In fact, even English shows that compositionality doesn't need complex grammar. The utterance, eat, drink, man, woman, is perfectly intelligible. But as the meaning is put together, it relies heavily on our cultural knowledge. The absence of complex, or any, syntax, doesn't scuttle the meaning. Many languages, if not all, have examples of meaningful sentences with little or no syntax. Another example from English would be, you drink, you drive, you go to jail. These three sentences have the same interpretation as the grammatically distinct and more complex construction, if you drink and drive, then you will go to jail. Note that the interpretation of separate sentences as a single sentence does not require prior knowledge of other syntactic possibilities, since we are able to use this kind of cultural understanding to interpret entire stories in multiple ways. One might object that sentences without sufficient syntax are ambiguous. They have multiple meanings and confuse the hearer. But, as noted in Chapter 4, even structured sentences like flying planes can be dangerous are ambiguous, in spite of English's elaborate syntax. One could eliminate or at least reduce ambiguity in a given language, but the means for doing so always include making the grammar more difficult or the list of words longer. And these strategies only make the language more complicated than it needs to be, by and large. So this is why, in all languages, ambiguous sentences are interpreted through native speaker knowledge of the context, the speaker, and their culture. The more closely the syntax matches the meaning, usually the easier the interpretation is. But much of grammar is a cultural choice. The form of a grammar is not genetically predestined. Linear grammars are not only the probable initial stage of syntax, but also still viable grammars for several modern languages. A linear grammar with symbols, intonation, and gestures is all a G1 language, the simplest full human language, requires. The next type of languages are G2 languages. These are languages that have hierarchical structures, like the tree diagrams of sentences and phrases, but lack recursion. Some have claimed that Piraha and Riau are examples, yet we need not focus exclusively on isolated or rarely spoken languages such as these. One researcher, Fred Carlson, claims that most European languages have hierarchy, but not recursion. Carlson bases his claim on the observation, "No genuine triple initial embeddings, nor any quadruple center embeddings are on record." Genuine, here, means sentences produced in natural, non-linguistic contexts, not sentences produced by professional linguists in the course of their theoretical argumentation. Embedding refers to placing one element inside another. Thus, one can take the phrase, John's father, and place this inside the larger phrase, John's father's uncle. Both of these are embedding. The difference between embedding, which is common in languages that, according to researchers like Carlson, have hierarchical structures without recursion, And recursion is simply that there is no bound on recursion. It can keep on going. So, what Carlson is saying is that in standard average European, SAE, languages, he only found sentences